Chapter 4. Hero. "Can't you just, like, shift to your wolf and heal?" Nancy Wheeler asks as Steve presses a hand to his naked side, doing nothing to staunch the blood oozing out where there are several large chunks of flesh missing. And Jesus Christ, it's been, like, the worst 2 days of Eddie's fucking life. First Chrissy, then Patrick. Then he joined this band of heroic idiots on their quest to find the real-life BBEG. He'd watched, a little dumbstruck because who does that, while Steve dove into the lake, got yanked through a gate to an alternate dimension, was feasted on by bats, and somehow came out the other side looking so metal that Eddie's currently having some kind of crisis. A different kind of crisis than the one he's been having about the rest of the events of the weekend. It's just the muscles, the bare chest, the must-hair, the proof that Harrington is, in fact, a fucking hero. Aragorn in disguise, the kids said, when Eddie had called him Strider. God, that was so accurate. Boy, does Eddie have a type or what? He wants to jump Steve's bones. Eddie blanches at that. Jesus, fuck, what is wrong with him? The man is injured, from being almost drowned and then eaten. How is Eddie even thinking about Steve's glorious fucking chest hair after all of that? He must be having a breakdown. No, I don't know what would happen if I shifted here. What if the Upside Down changes me, or the kids? Steve presses his dirty hand against the open wounds again, and Eddie is pretty sure that that is not a good idea. It's not worth the risk. I'll heal, just a lot slower. Steve, stop touching it, he thinks to himself. Steve, stop touching it, Nancy admonishes, voicing exactly what Eddie was thinking. Eddie snorts into his hand. Robin jabs her bony elbow into his side for it. He grunts because her elbows are like daggers. Nancy rips the bottom of her shirt off, wrapping Steve around the middle. It's less of a bandage and more of an obstacle to keep his hands off of it, but it's all they've got for now. Before he even realizes he's doing it, Eddie has pulled his battle vest off and tossed it at Harrington. If his oof is any indication, Eddie probably should have warned the guy. For your modesty, dude. Thanks. Steve shrugs it on, grimacing as he stretches his arms to reach the armholes, probably pulling on the open wounds. Then they're walking, and Eddie can't seem to settle down. He's exhausted and scared, and walking in an alternate universe next to a half-naked guy that he has hated for years, but who's actually proven to be the selfless hero everyone says he is. Plus, he's so fucking hot that Eddie is having a second gay crisis or something. And Eddie just can't settle down. Bouncing on the balls of his feet, he leans into Steve's space. So, you and Wheeler, true love? Steve looks at him weird. That's okay. Eddie is weird. And he needs to distract himself before he falls in love with Steve because he cannot think of a worse scenario than falling for the straight former bully just because he's suddenly a nice guy. No, that's like an after-school special waiting to happen. Or it would be if they made those about gay kids. Of course, if they did, the gay kid would be some kind of deviant or sicko, because that's how straight people see gay people. Jesus, Eddie needs to get away from this man and his chest hair. Even his thoughts are rambling now. I mean, fuck, Harrington. She just jumped right in after you. No hesitation. They both did. I would have left you there. I am not a hero, but those girls, jeez, take your pick. He thumbs back at the girls, or forward at them since they're walking ahead. Steve snorts, shaking his head. Munson. He leans in close to Eddie's ear, and Eddie wants to run, but he suddenly feels trapped, having tables turned on him. I know for a fact that neither of them feels that way about me. Remember? He taps the side of his nose, and suddenly Eddie does. Please don't say it, Harrington, he begs silently. It's amazing how much you can tell about a person just by the way he smells. Not how they smell, he said, how he smells. Fuck. Oh, fuck. He fucking knows. He knows Eddie is gay as fuck and that he wants to shove his tongue down Harrington's throat. Oh, dear God. It would be great if a monster could eat him right now. Abort. Distract. Do something. He laughs, cackles really, going too far as usual. Yeah, that seems unfair. You get a cheat guide to hormones and attraction, and the rest of us slobs have to just, what, figure it all out on our own. Eddie, I'm... Hey, dinguses, Robin calls back, because they've gotten pretty far apart. For a brief moment, Steve rests his hand on Eddie's lower back, but before Eddie can spiral from gay crisis to gay disaster, Steve says, come on. They head to Nancy Wheeler's house. For guns, at first, but then when they get there, Steve says the kids are there, too. What do you mean, the kids are here? Robin asks him, as they trudge up the driveway. They're here, but on the other side. It's faint, but I can feel them. Max, Lucas, and Dustin. Mike is still west, but I think he's moving closer. Slowly, though. Steve looks in a direction that Eddie assumes is California. He makes a low whine in his throat that reminds Eddie of Strider. Possibly because he is Strider. He wonders if that means that Steve is a snuggler, too, but he cuts that thought off at the knees. Nope, not dealing with that right now. What? Nancy stops as she's opening the front door. Mike isn't still with the buyers? Nance, I don't know. He brushes past her, shining his flashlight around the empty room. It doesn't work like that, and I'm in another dimension. Or hell. Or an alternate universe. Whatever. Ask me on the other side. I can only concentrate on the ones here right now. It's all three of them. With a huff, Nancy heads toward the staircase, and they all follow her up to her bedroom. She goes straight to the closet, bringing down a pale pink shoebox, tossing the lid and unfolding the tissue paper. To reveal a pair of heels. Those aren't guns, Eddie points out. The heels are a bit pointy, but I was hoping for something along the lines of a projectile, Robin says tensely. Nancy is obviously confused. I don't understand. Maybe you left them somewhere else, Eddie offers. She bristles. There's a 6-year-old in the house. I know where I keep my guns. Which is not something Eddie thought he'd ever hear Nancy fucking Wheeler say. Indignantly, she turns back to the box. And also, I threw these away years ago. Okay, ma'am, Eddie thinks, and turns to see what Steve thinks, but Steve's not there. He must have stayed downstairs. Eddie really doesn't like being separated. He's about to mention it and head off to look for him when Nancy picks up a stack of decaying flashcards and starts cycling through them like she's looking for something. I get that grades are important to you, Robin says, nervous and on edge. But perhaps studying can wait until we get out of here. These are from sophomore chemistry. And this wallpaper. She points at the wall. This is old. And this mirror went to a yard sale. And you, she grabs a teddy bear off her bed. I gave you to Cousin Joanna 2 years ago. Rounding her bed, she picks up what is obviously a young girl's diary off the side table. It's floral with a matching pen that rolls off onto the floor. Flipping back and forth, she settles on what must be the final entry. What is it? Eddie asks. Nancy, Robin steps toward her. You're freaking me out. Nancy looks up from the diary with big round eyes. I think the reason that my guns aren't here is because they don't exist yet. They don't exist, Eddie repeats. This diary should be full of entries. It's not. The last day is November 6th, 1983, the day Will went missing, the day the gate opened. We're in the past. That can't be right. Dustin, Steve calls from downstairs, sounding distraught. Dustin! Dustin! Rushing downstairs, they find Steve circling the living room, flashlight sweeping back and forth. Shh, I think I hear him, Eddie shushes them. Sure enough, they can hear the kid very faintly, like he's talking through water. Dustin! Nancy yells, walking past where his voice is echoing. They all start calling for him. All right, either he can't hear us or he's being a total douchebag, Steve mumbles, shining the flashlight around the Wheeler living room again. Will found a way, Nancy says. What? Steve asks, turning the light toward her. Will, she says, like he should know this. He found a way to talk to Joyce, through the lights. She runs over to a dimmer switch, twisting it on and off, but nothing happens. Steve points at the light switch, and she jiggles it up and down. He turns in a circle again, looking for any sign it's working. Pointing his flashlight towards the chandelier over the table, he whispers, Guys, you seeing this? The lights above them start to glow, the air around them filling with light particles. Nancy waves her fingers through it and swirls them around. Eddie reaches up for the particles, too. They feel like static electricity. Steve and Robin reach up, too. It tickles, Steve says with wonder. It kind of feels good, Robin agrees. Nancy pulls her hand back. Does anyone know Morse code? No, Steve says immediately. Wait, Eddie looks down at her. Does SOS count? He looks between her and Robin. Is that good? He knew teaching himself SOS would come in handy one day. He kind of wishes he could call his fifth grade teacher and tell her that, no, his time wasn't wasted learning SOS instead of writing that book report. Thank you very much. It's working, Robin says, as Eddie starts tapping it out onto the light cloud, and the lights tap on and off to his rhythm. Dustin says from far away, hey, remember when I said they weren't stupid enough to go through the water gate? There's a muffled answer, and then Dustin continues, I overestimated them. He's such an asshole, Steve sighs, shaking his head like a disappointed mom. Eventually, they work out how to communicate with the kids through a light bright, which is admittedly cool as shit, and where to meet. The gate in Eddie's trailer, all the way across town. They have more important things to worry about right now, but it's a long bike ride and Eddie's mind loves to wander, loves to work out puzzles. He can't help but think that maybe this isn't actually an upside-down version of Hawkins. It's more like a set piece from a play set in Hawkins 1983. Something tells him that none of this was here before November of 1983. And the only new thing to enter the Upside Down in 1983 was a little boy from Hawkins, Will Byers. He wonders how much input Byers had on this place and if he's even aware of it, if he could do it on purpose. They've got a girl with superpowers and a pack of shapeshifters. Why not a boy whose imagination shapes reality? Because Eddie has a feeling that the Upside Down Hawkins probably ends at the edge of town. Maybe when Will Byers found himself alone and afraid in a world of monsters, he built a place that he felt safe to hide in. He built his home. Hawkins, Indiana. When the four of them get to the gate, and all the kids waiting at the top, bottom, of the hole torn in the ceiling of Eddie's trailer, the BBEG decides to show Nancy what his plans are. And all thoughts of Will Byers and whether or not he can shape reality are whisked away for more imminent apocalyptic-level problems. They're at Max's trailer, trying to hash out a plan to stop the monster from destroying the world. Eddie doesn't even know what day it is at this point. He damn sure doesn't know how he got on Team Save the World. Everyone is exhausted. He and Steve and Nancy and Robin all smell pretty awful, but no one seems to care. Especially not the three kids who are all curled up against Steve. They're all touching Max somehow, too. Dustin and Lucas each holding one of her hands as she leans against Steve. Max, with her chin tilted in defiance, headphones blaring Kate Bush on a seemingly endless loop. Max, the Spitfire redhead who Eddie really, really doesn't want suffering the same fate as the cheerleader he couldn't save. Y'all are so weird, Erica says snidely. She'd come with them from the Wheelers and was keeping her distance, informing them that they all smelled bad, but Steve smelled like roadkill. Max huffs out a bitter laugh. It's about to get weirder. Can we shift for a bit? I think it's harder for Vecna to get me when I'm shifted, and I just need a short break. She doesn't say what the short break is from, but they all know it's from fighting to stay alive, which must be exhausting. One by one, they each go into the bathroom to strip down and change. Within a few minutes, there's a pile of overgrown dogs on the floor. They're all distinctly different. Max is more red than brown, cream-colored on her underbelly and throat, and her eyes are a bright, vibrant blue, and she looks more like an overgrown fox than a wolf. And Lucas is a dark chocolate brown with the same style of markings as Dustin, lighter fur on his cheeks and underbelly. He's smaller than Steve, but bigger than the other two. Can we? Eddie starts, fingers itching to pet, but he doesn't really know the rules here. Robin laughs, plopping down to scratch behind Max's ears. Yes, they love it. Steve says they don't feel human like this, so it's not weird. I'm not rubbing Max's ears, I'm scratching a wolf's ears. You just gotta separate the two. Steve will sometimes shift when we watch a movie together. He told me once that it was important for them to touch their humans, too. I think he was telling me that I belong to them. Pretty sure you do now, too. Eddie highly doubts that, but he runs his fingers through Lucas's shiny, sleek fur anyway. Nancy sits down daintily, tucking her feet in close to her body. Mike, too, she shares. As soon as we're alone in the house, he shifts and rubs against my legs, makes me sit and pet him. And since the change, he's super affectionate, always hugging me and Mom and Holly. Trying to with Dad, but you know, it's not manly to be touching other men at your age. She rolls her eyes. This is manly. Steve, always making sure the kids are safe, loved. Strider nudges Dustin in Nancy's direction, and the goofball flops down in front of her and rolls over onto his side, exposing his belly fur for scratches. There's a few moments of silence while they all scratch and pet. Eddie tries not to think about them as human because that feels wrong. And Steve had said they were always wolves. That makes it feel different because this is their natural state. Well, maybe not natural. Actually, it helps when Eddie calls him Strider in wolf form. Maybe he should come up with cool names for the rest of them. I think he blames himself about Max, Robin says, interrupting Eddie's thought process. But it was me. He knew something was wrong. We talked about it a few times, that she was shutting him out, and I told him that sometimes it's better to give people space. She sniffles. Max turns her head and licks Robin's cheek, making her laugh quietly as she buries her face into Max's neck in what Eddie thinks is apology. You couldn't have known, Eddie reassures her. And you weren't wrong. Sometimes space is the most important thing people can give us. Some things we need to figure out alone. He's thinking of all the times he'd raged against the love that Wayne so easily offered, and how he'd never come searching for Eddie or come into his room to force conversations. He'd just waited for Eddie to come to him. And Eddie always had. Had eventually realized that his uncle would always be waiting for him with open arms. Eddie's heart clenches in his chest when he thinks about Wayne and what he must think of him right now. He wants to run his fingers through Strider's fur, bury his face into the wolf's neck like he did for weeks on end, reassure himself that Strider and his solid presence are there. But he doesn't dare. He's already given too much away. Instead, he alternates between Dustin and Lucas, occasionally running a finger down Max's shorter snout. She playfully nips at him each time. After 15 or 20 minutes of quiet bonding, Strider nudges Dustin, who goes to change and comes back looking calmer, still grinning like he usually does. Kid is so damn happy to just exist every day. Eddie doesn't ever want to see him any other way. Lucas goes next, then Steve, giving Max extra time in her safer form. When Steve comes back, still in his gray pajamas and Eddie's vest, chest bared, Eddie notices the bandage is gone. He reaches out to touch and then realizes what he's doing, snatches his hand back. Steve opens the vest, though, showing the smooth, healed skin where there were gnarly gnat bites half an hour ago. Holy shit, man, that's amazing! Without thinking, Eddie looks higher, brushing his fingers across the now unblemished skin of Steve's throat where the bat had strangled him. Steve sucks in a breath. Eddie snatches his hand back. Sorry, does it hurt? Steve shakes his head, murky hazel eyes intense and focused. No. Oh. Oh. They have a plan. It's not the best plan. They're splitting the party. The boys and Eddie share a look about it because they know you never split the party, but they've got no alternative plan, so they're in. Each group has one of the wolves in it, which means they'll at least know where everyone is. They won't be able to communicate, though, unless they shift, and Steve doesn't want them doing that in the Upside Down if they can avoid it. Steve's really not happy about using Max as bait, but the kid stood her ground, saying she can die cowering with her tail between her legs, or she can fight. And she'd rather fight. Gotta admire her gumption. Steve had had to step outside after that. Max had given him a few minutes and then followed. By the time they had come back in, both with red-rimmed eyes, the rest of the plan had been set. Time to hotwire an RV. After that, and an eventful and dangerous trip to the Army surplus store, they've pulled the stolen RV into a meadow to prepare. Eddie and Dustin make their shields, hammering nails into them while they laugh at each other's terrible jokes. A little ways away from them, Eddie can hear Lucas using the cover of Making Spears to talk to Erica about whether or not she really wants to do this. He's a good brother. Erica is only 11, and even though she's just the lookout, Eddie can see the worry on Lucas's face. Sure, he's terrified of his little sister. They all are. But she's still his little sister, and he's probably terrified for her, too. Max is with Nancy, helping her saw the end off her shotgun, which is incredibly illegal, but Eddie's pretty sure neither of those Spitfire girls will let something like a felony deter them. Please, he thinks to himself, whatever gods are out there listening, let this kid make it through safely. She deserves a fucking break. Max is the calmest he's seen her since this all began. She's also watching Nancy with a little bit of hero worship. Eddie can't say he blames her. He'd been surprised by Nancy Wheeler. There's so much strength in her delicate form, a fierce determination like he's never seen before. Years ago, when King Steve had dated Nancy Wheeler, it had seemed like a match made in high school sweetheart heaven, the kind of couple that gets married after college, pops out a few kids, and leads a relatively perfect but mediocre existence. He can't reconcile that with the Nancy and Steve he knows now. She seems determined to prove herself to the world in a way that will shake its very foundation, and Steve seems like he'd prefer a quiet, uneventful life, but he'll bring his bat just in case. What was that Teddy Roosevelt quote Mrs. Glick told them every year? Speak softly, but carry a big stick. That's Steve. He's nothing like the person Eddie thought he would be. He had been, once upon a time, but not now. Glancing over toward the RV, Eddie watches Robin and Steve talking quietly and making Molotov cocktails together. They've got a special bond that Eddie doesn't really understand. He's admittedly a little jealous, even if it isn't romantic. While Eddie's watching them, Steve looks up from the bottle in his hand, catching Eddie's eye and smiling softly. Eddie feels his cheeks redden and he looks back at where Henderson is brandishing his trash can lid. Hefting his own, he declares, "Hear me now, there will be no more retreating for Eddie the Banished." Dustin giggles, lifting his own trash lid to make one of his terrible puns. "Hey, you're really ready for battle." He forces a dorky giggle when Eddie stares at him without blinking. You get it? Eddie just keeps staring. Battle. B-A-T. Sighing, Dustin puts down his trash can shield. No? I thought that was a good one. No, he gets it. It's just so bad. Eddie tackles him for it. What are you doing? Dustin grunts, wrestling against Eddie until Eddie pushes him away, grinning wildly. Rushing forward, Dustin crashes against Eddie's midsection, playfully shouting, "You son of a bitch!" They tussle back and forth, and Dustin shrieks, "No wedgies! No wedgies!" God, he loves this kid. He pulls him up, grabs him around the back of his goofy cap, and grins in his face. Never change, Dustin Henderson. Promise me. The nervousness on Dustin's face as he insists, "Wasn't planning on it," is a nervousness that Eddie recognizes. Like maybe someone Dustin loved left him once, and the kid's still a little afraid this is a goodbye. Eddie understands that fear. Both his parents had left him on the same day, after all. He squeezes Dustin's head, gives him a gentle shake and a hopefully reassuring smile. Good. Good. Dustin smiles back, looks like he's breathing easier when he repeats, "Good." As Eddie disentangles himself from Dustin, he's tackled to the ground by a sleek brown wolf and a small red one. Both wolves yipping in excitement as Eddie tries to defend his face from cold noses and drool. He's just sitting up, hair a mess with pieces of grass and twigs, when Dustin's light brown wolf joins the pile, knocking Eddie flat again. All three wolves are wrestling each other, and Eddie is just caught in the crossfire, laughing and covering his face from flying paws and tails. Suddenly, there's a loud bark and all three go alert, still, ears and tails up, muscles tensed, all looking toward the RV. There's a thunder of paws and a larger gray wolf barrels toward them. All three of the smaller ones race away, yipping and pushing into each other as Strider chases them across the meadow. Eddie sits up to watch them play. Robin, Nancy, and Erica all wander over to sit with him in the grass. "It's weird, right?" Nancy says, eyes tracking the pack as they wrestle in the long grass. Robin leans into Eddie. He likes her. He thinks she might be like him. Maybe Steve, too, if those little looks he keeps giving Eddie mean what Eddie hopes they mean. It is, but like, good weird, Robin replies. I mean, everything with us is weird, but this has been good weird. Erica snarks. Lucas has always been weird. The only difference now is that when it rains, he smells like a wet dog. Robin snorts. So does Eddie. You know Lucas can smell that you love him, right? Robin says with a knowing smile. Erica looks disgusted about it. Steve told me once that scent for them is more than just smell. It's feelings and intentions or something like that. That there's nothing anyone can hide from them anymore. With a cringe, Eddie says, well, that's disturbing. Tell me about it. Robin bumps his shoulder in what he thinks is solidarity. It's nice that they have each other, though. Nancy plucks a long blade of grass, pulling it apart in strands. I mean, Dustin, Lucas, and Mike have families, but Max and Steve really don't. And sure, we're all a family, but this is different. Mike tried to explain it to me once, that they belong to each other. They watch quietly as Strider races in a wide circle, the three kids trying to cut him off and catch him, but failing as he slips past them each time. He darts in occasionally, nipping at their ankles before dancing away. Finally, he takes a wide berth and comes up alongside their small group of humans, rubbing his side along their backs, nosing around their necks and licking each of their cheeks. While they're screaming and pushing him away, the other three overgrown mutts duck in and do the same. By the end of whatever the ritual is, Eddie smells even more disgusting than before. And before was not good, considering he's been wearing the same clothes for a week and walked through hell. Once everyone shifts and climbs back into the RV, he must make a face because Max grins, gloating. It's like when a cat rubs its face on you, marking, so the other animals know you belong to us. Sidling up, Dustin adds nonchalantly, we know from experience that it doesn't help to keep the monsters away, but we still feel compelled to do it, sort of like marking our territory. He grins widely. Just be glad no one peed in your shoes. What the fuck, man? Pushing a cackling Dustin away, Eddie gets up, moves to the front of the RV, and slides into the empty passenger seat across from Steve. What's wrong with your kids, Harrington? Steve smiles fondly without looking at him. Dustin threatened to pee in your shoes. When Eddie balks at that, Steve assures him, we don't have the urge to do that, he's just messing with you. Steve shrugs, pushing his thoroughly fucked up hair behind his ear. Marking is so far the most animal-like part of this, and I can't really explain it. You humans are a part of our pack, but you shower away our smell and, I don't know, I just don't feel safe until everyone smells like us. Your pack? Eddie adjusts so he's sitting sideways and can stare unabashedly at Steve while he drives. Family, but different. It's hard to explain. It's what I always wanted, though. 6 kids and a Winnebago. He laughs, gesturing to the stolen Winnebago he's currently driving, and the pack of children in the back. Honestly, if I could turn you all into wolves, I probably would. He sounds shy about it, like he's admitting a dirty secret. Eddie has one, too. And since Steve shared his... That would be metal as fuck, Harrington. Count me in. They shouldn't have split the parties, and Eddie shouldn't have tried to be a hero. If the taste of copper in his throat is anything to go by, it's too late to worry about that now. Dustin is sobbing somewhere nearby, the sky is dark and smoky, and Eddie's body feels so heavy and wet. When he takes in a big breath, it feels like he's breathing through a wet bag with a hole in it, and he hurts everywhere. He tries to talk, to tell Dustin he's sorry. To tell Dustin to take care of the other nuggets, but he can't. Dustin's sob turns into a howl. It's loud and filled with pain, with fear, sorrow. It feels like there's not enough air in the entire world for Eddie to even take a breath. To tell Dustin it's okay, that it'll be okay. He thinks of his D&D sessions, of his friends, of band practice, of music, of collecting the little lost sheep. The nerds, the outcasts, tucking them under his wing to keep them safe. Dustin will do it, even if Eddie doesn't have the breath to tell him. He'll know. He can't think of Wayne, though, because then he'll try to live, and he knows he's not going to. He can feel his life dripping out through the rips and tears in his skin. He blinks, and he thinks maybe time passes, or maybe it's still the same moment. He's not sure. Harrington is here now. Steve. His beautiful face filled with concern and something that looks like fear. He's talking, but Eddie can't keep a hold of the words. Steve's expression steals in that famous Harrington determination that Eddie's gotten to know in the last week. Steve's head dips down, lips almost pressed against Eddie's cheek, and for a brief moment, he thinks it's a goodbye kiss. This will work. It has to, Steve promises, though, right into the shell of Eddie's ear, and then Eddie feels a cold nose against his throat and a searing pain where his neck and his shoulder meet. He tries to scream, but he still doesn't have enough air. A thready whine escapes instead, and then everything goes black. End of chapter 4.